Nothing like a little seeker and sensitive music to begin our Sunday morning off with. That's one of those songs just warms your heart, don't it? Maybe not. Keith Green, if I have not told you lately, I want to be just like Jesus, but if I can't hit that mark, if I could be like Keith Green, I think I will come somewhere close. If you are not familiar with the music or the ministry of Keith Green, I would just say your spiritual life can probably use a good dose of it. When I became a Christian, one of my first youth ministers, his name was Kenny. Kenny said, "Man, if I can do two things for you, I will consider my job well done." He said, "Number one, if I can introduce you to Oswald Chambers, and you can start reading Oswald Chambers, my utmost for his highest." He goes, "And number two, if I can introduce you to Keith Green and get you to like him," he said, "I believe your spiritual growth will have greater potential as a result of knowing those two people." And I would say he is right. He would bring me over his house, Mike, or he'd come over mine, and he'd turn on Keith Green. And Keith Green's music, man, it's kind of deep. It's not a lot of fluff stuff. And it's one of those types of music you don't listen to just in the car. It's not like bebop-y type music. It really is kind of soul-searching, kind of heart-rendering. And we would turn off the lights. We'd just sit there on the floor, and we just worship. And that was one of my favorite ones. And so, by request, Mike, you and Sandy, y'all did me proud. I think you would have done Keith proud. She really did a good job on that piano, tickling those ivories. Very, very good. Y'all just need to be thankful I didn't join in singing. I wanted to. Mike wouldn't let me, though. And really trying to work through that bitterness. Anyways. Hey, take your Bibles this morning. We're going to be in the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 2. Nehemiah chapter 2. We'll begin in verse 1. Nehemiah chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. Before I read, let me share with you a little bit about my journey. When I became a Christian, I was 16 years old. I really didn't know much except that God so loved Matt that He gave His only Son, that if I would believe in Him, I would not have to perish, but that I can have everlasting life. As I read the Scriptures and I began knowing a little bit more about God, who I was, as a sinner, where I was going because of my sin, and learning that Jesus Christ demonstrated His love towards me. And while I was yet a sinner, He died for me. I thought to myself, I remember, no one's ever loved me like that. Nobody has ever given their life for me. And I'm telling you guys, it really did just melt my heart. And so as I became a Christian, I was overwhelmed with this desire to share the gospel with my friends. And I've told you the story. I remember saying to God, "God, I'll pay you if you'll let me do this. I would love for the rest of my life to just be a preacher. I would love just for the rest of my life just to try to tell people about Christ." Well, I was saved in a Baptist church. I was called to preach in a Baptist church. I was nurtured in my newfound faith in a Southern Baptist church. Well, when I was 18 years old that summer, I went on a revival team. It was a state-sponsored denominational revival team, and we would go all throughout the state, and we would do two revivals a week. We'd do a revival starting on Sunday night, going through Wednesday, and then we would start another revival on Friday night, going through Sunday morning, and then we would travel in between. We did that all summer long. As a matter of fact, I did it the summer of 1993 and the summer of 1992. So both of those summers, I was in many, many Southern Baptist churches there in our state of South Carolina. Well, something began to dawn upon me as I was kind of spreading my wings and getting outside of my own church. I began to realize, you know, churches, they really do have a lot in common, especially Baptist churches. What I found in that time is that really all Baptist churches do it the same. All Baptist churches, no matter where you go to, probably you will find some type of semblance within those. There's always going to be like a call to worship. Somebody's always going to start off, whether it be a choir special or a song, there's always going to be something to call people to worship. And then we're going to sing a few hymns, and then the pastor was going to get up, and he was going to pray for the offering, and then they would do the national anthem or the doxology, and they would do that, and then they would have a special music. And sometimes it wasn't as special as it could have been because of the limited talent pool, but they gave it the best they could. And then the preacher would get to preach, and then after the preacher preaches, there's the invitation. The pastor says any announcements or any last tidbits for the people. And then we'd all go home. Well, that happened in every church I was a part of. And so today, if you were to go to Yellow Pages and you were in a different city or whatever, and you want to find a Southern Baptist church, you look under Southern Baptist churches, you go, and pretty much, by and large, wherever you go, you would find that same semblance. You would find that same order within the church. Churches, at least Southern Baptist churches, we have a lot in common. Well, as I got into seminary, I started again going to different churches outside of our Southern Baptist churches. And especially as I began in the pastorate, I started going to conferences, places that were outside of our denominational ranks. And what I found was different people did it different ways. Southern Baptists didn't have a monopoly on structure. Southern Baptists didn't have a monopoly on the way things should be done. And so I saw some things from other churches. I said, you know, that's kind of neat how they do it that way. That's interesting. Never seen it done that way before. And there was a lot of things that I saw. I was like, man, I'm glad I'm a Southern Baptist. I'm glad I do it the way that I do it. But it almost became a prideful thing, you know, after a while, because I would nitpick, as you would too, and you critique, and you see things that you like. And the reason why you're a Southern Baptist, it's pretty much by choice. I remember one professor, he said before his class, every class he had, how proud he was to be a Southern Baptist. It was a Southern Baptist school. He was in good company, but there was this one little Methodist girl that was in the class, and she had to sit through this entire semester and hearing her professor say how proud he was of being a Southern Baptist. Finally, she couldn't take it anymore. She got up enough gumption. She said, hey, I just want to ask you, sir, what would you be if you were not a Southern Baptist? Almost without even a glitch, or I mean, it's like he was prepared for the question. He said, ashamed. And so, man, he was just proud to be a Southern Baptist. And by and large, there's a lot of Southern Baptists just that way. If you were not a Southern Baptist, you too would find yourself ashamed. You're grateful for your heritage, and there's a lot to be said for that. However, problem is, in our Southern Baptist churches, sometimes we do believe, and we bought into the notion that we do have some monopoly on the truth of the way things should be done. I'm reading a book right now, or I've read it before, I'm rereading again, called Breakout Churches by Tom Rainer. It's interesting. A lot of the books that I've read recently are by Tom Rainer. Tom Rainer, his research group, they do a lot of studies amongst different churches. The book outside in the vestibule you'll see is The Simple Church. She did another book prior to that called Breakout Churches. They interviewed 50,000 churches, not just Southern Baptists, but all different types of churches, 50,000 churches. And amongst those 50,000, they were looking for breakout churches. Now, their criteria for a breakout church was this, and follow this. They had to at least have a ratio of membership to baptisms, 20 to 1. Now, that's not very good, but comparison to the rest of the churches, you are actually doing very good. If you have 20 members to every one baptism in a given year. And so to be a breakout church, you had to have a 20 to 1 ratio. You also had to be, or had to have had, a period of decline or plateau in your history. And so it wasn't just churches that were doing real well. You had to actually have a church that was doing well, and then they went through a decline or a downward turn. But the other criteria was it had to have the same pastor. See, oftentimes new pastors come in with new ideas, fresh ideas, and so the church kind of gets a jump start, if you will. Well, they were not looking for that. They wanted to find breakout churches that had the same pastor, same leader, who have gone through a period of decline or a period of plateauing, that came out of that plateau and decline through the same leadership and experienced breakout. Now, out of 40,000, follow this, 40,000 churches in America, they surveyed 50,000 in-depth. Out of 50,000 in-depth, they came up with 13 churches. You let that sink in. 50,000 churches. They want to find breakout churches, those who have been going through a period of decline, plateauing, and then they launch from that plateau or decline into a period of growth and health and stability under the same leadership, baptizing per ratio 20 members to 1. Only 13 met the criteria. The book was encouraging for many people. It was discouraging, however, for others. Because many people, as they read the books, they saw that, many people began turning their attention away from the established institutional church. And they really thought the established institutional church had had its day and had run its course. However, I want you to understand something very clearly. I'm your pastor, and I'm your pastor by conviction, believing it to be the calling of God, but I'm also your pastor by choice. I have not given up on the institutional local church. I do not believe we have run our course, and I do believe that God still has a plan for the local institutionalized church. Now, some might disagree, and they can be wrong, but I'm going to share with you today some of the challenges, or from the challenges that we've already discussed, I'm going to share with you some of my ideas, some of my paradigms, if you will, as far as how we are going to do it, how we are going to meet the challenge, how we're going to prove the naysayers wrong, how we're going to meet the challenges of our day. And so many people, again, given up. I have not. And I think I'm surrounded by a group of people that would believe the same thing. Nehemiah's day was not very much different. In Nehemiah's day, many people had given up. Many people had said things have gone wrong, and things have been wrong for too long. And so you cannot fix that which has been broken for so long. And so many people wiped their hands. Many people had just succumbed to the fact that this is the way it's always going to be. And as a result, there wasn't much hope in the land, much hope in the remnant, not much that you can find. And yet, when Nehemiah heard the words, things are in ruin, the remnant has only survived, the reproach is great, and God is not glorified any longer in the city. Nehemiah sat down, he wept. The Bible says for 4 months he prayed, he mourned, he stood before God, and his time came. In chapter 2, he stood before the king as the cupbearer, and it goes like this. And it came about in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, that wine was before him. And I took up the wine and I gave to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence. So the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, though you're not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart." Then I was very much afraid. And I said to the king, "Let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire?" Then the king said to me, "What would you request?" And then I prayed to the God of heaven. And by the way, you do know you can pray and talk at the same time. You ever been in a conversation before? Somebody asks you a question, you're like, "Oh, dear God, give me the words." That's basically what Nehemiah is doing right now. "Dear God, don't let me mess this up. This is my moment. Please do not let me mess this up." So he said, he prayed to the God of heaven. Verse 5, "And I said to the king, if it please the king, and if your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. Then the king said to me," the queen sitting beside him, "how long will your journey be, and when will you return?" So it pleased the king to send me, and I gave him a definite time. And I said to the king, "If it please the king, let letters be given me for the governors of the provinces beyond the river, that they may allow me to pass through until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's force, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress which is by the temple, for the wall of the city, and for the house to which I will go." And the king granted them to me because the good hand of my God was on me. And Nehemiah, apparently, during these 4 months of praying and fasting, Nehemiah also came up with a plan. And his plan he was able to give to the king. And God seemed to be the orchestrator of all these circumstances, and even the orchestrator of the king and his heart and his willingness to let his chief guy, one of his great counselors, his cupbearer, to go. Nehemiah said, "I gave him a specific time." Nehemiah was able to talk not in generalities, but in specifics. What I like today to do is not talk so much in generalities, but I like to talk into some specifics. Many people have asked, again, the question, well, what are we going to do, Matt? You talk about these challenges that are before us. You talk about the need of our generation to reach the upcoming generation. Well, what's that going to mean for us? What's that going to mean for First Baptist? As I've shared with you some of my concerns and some of my dilemmas as far as understanding culture and being behind the curveball as far as understanding the heartland of America, not growing up here, there are some things that are transferable, and there's some paradigms that I am working from. So I'd like to show you some things here today to give you a little idea as far as the future and the future history of the First Baptist Church. You see here, P, paradigm, is basically this. A paradigm is a generalized sense of understanding that a community, a body, a business, a group has. A paradigm is an agreed-upon set of values, core beliefs, set goals, agendas. It is what makes up the DNA of any organization. So whether you're a spiritual organization, a secular organization, whether you're a church, a business, a paradigm is an agreed-upon set of understanding that everything else works out from. Out of a paradigm, you'll find your strategy. Every paradigm has a strategy for how you're going to accomplish those agreed-upon set of goals, staying true to those agreed-upon set of values. And out of the strategy, you have little action points. Action points are how you're going to carry out the strategy that's going to fulfill the paradigm. Now, when people have heard about change in the First Baptist Church and with this new pastor and all that, there's been some fear. There's been some animosity. Well, how's that going to? What's that going to mean for us? How are we going to be different? What am I not going to like? And what's going to happen to this program? What's going to happen here? What are we going to do with this? All of this and that falls in action points. If you are talking to me about action points, you are light years ahead of your pastor. Okay, because when I'm talking about change, when I'm talking about meeting challenges and thinking differently, I'm not talking about action points. I'm not talking about action points like Sunday school yet. I'm not talking about action points like Sunday night worship, action points like Wednesday night worship, action points like whatever ministry you might have. When I'm talking about change, when I'm talking about meeting the challenges before us, I'm talking about a whole new way of thinking about church, a whole new paradigm, a whole new understanding about why we are what we are, why we do what we do, why we meet here every Sunday, and out of this ministry, what are we to be about in regards to fulfilling the Great Commission? Now, that might trouble some of you. That might, to some of you, think, oh my goodness, I'd much rather talk about action points. You're thinking about a completely different way of thinking about church, and that would be yes. I sure am. Well, what are the specifics as far as your paradigm is concerned? I'm going to give you four of them because I really have these past 2 weeks really tried to narrow my focus and really tried to come up and put it into words of what I want to say to you this morning. Okay, so if you want to write these down, that will be very helpful to you. You can pray through these. We can talk about them. We will some tonight. First paradigm is a paradigm of institutional ministry versus missional ministry. For almost all of our century, the church has functioned, by and large, in an institutionalized ministry approach. Institutional ministry is the idea of we're looking for people to help the institution grow. Now, I'm going to share with you next week, and by the way, I cannot tell you how excited I am about next week. Next week, I was so tempted to erase this message and tell you next week's message, and then get back to this message next week. Next week, I'm going to talk about generational differences. And I'm going to talk about why we have conflict sometime in our churches, because you know what? We just come from different generations. And I've learned a lot in these past few weeks, especially in the past month, about generational differences. I've grown in my appreciation for the different generations, especially, and I'm not just saying this because most of you fall in this category, but especially the World War II generation. You've got some great things about you. As a matter of fact, much of what we enjoy here at First Baptist as a result of the builders, and the builders, they grew the institutions. They grew the institutions of America that we enjoy today so much, by and large. And yet, in the heyday of Southern Baptist life, if you go back in history, the heyday of Southern Baptist life was the 1950s. In the 1950s, institutionalized ministry boomed. Southern Baptist boomed. We outgrew all the other denominations. We had it going on. We were doing it right. And we were facing and meeting the demands that our culture had. And yet, what has happened is we have stuck to an institutionalized ministry when the culture has changed. And we'll talk more about that next week. But for by and large today, I want to share with you the difference between institutionalized ministry and missional ministry. Institutionalized ministry is, we see people in our congregation, look at people and we say, you know what, this person, he has a lot to offer. We'll look at a Miss Pam over here, and we'll say, you know, Miss Pam, she's a go-getter. Man, she's got a lot of good qualities about her. And we say, man, what does she do for a living? Where does she put her time? Where does she put her resources? What are her skills? We would like to take her and her skills, and we would like to incorporate those into our church to make our church, our institution, bigger and hopefully better. And we'll look around other people and we'll see, hey, this person has great characteristics. This person's a leader in our community. This person has different gifts. This person has different skills. They have prominence in our community. They have been elevated, whether by the hand of God or themselves. And we would like to see those people, by and large, come into our organization to make our organization better and bigger. Because, again, the goal is, for the longest time, has been to grow the institution that we call church. Well, here's how the paradigm's different. That's the old paradigm I've just shared with you. The new paradigm is, instead of saying, you know what, Mr. Bob Taylor over here, what he does over there at Durham, instead of just saying to Bob, Bob, all the gifts that you have and all that you use over there at Durham and how you use that over there and how they benefit from your services and your understanding and your leadership skills, instead of saying, we'd like to come and talk to you about how you can get involved in our organization. We'd like to pull you out of your place of influence. We'd like to pull you out of your environment. And we'd like to take you into this environment and to try to exhaust and leverage your influence and your skills and your leadership to make us as an institution bigger and better. That's old paradigm. New paradigm is this. Bob, we're not so much interested in so much what you can do for the institution. But Bob, you work at Durham. And in Durham, you have certain people that look up to you. You have certain people that answer to you. You have a group of people that you have influence with. And Bob Taylor, what we would like to do is we'd like to come alongside you as a church. And we'd like to equip you. We would like to help you think outside the box. We would like to help you leverage your influence that you have over there at Durham so that you can exhaust that influence where you already are for the sake of leading people to a relationship with Jesus Christ, or at least moving them along in the path towards, hopefully, a relationship with Jesus Christ one day. Do you see the difference? That is a paradigm shift I've just talked about. Instead of trying to get the Bob Taylors or whoever they might be into this institution to help this institution be bigger and better, the church is saying, we are now going to go to where you are, because where you are is where God's already planted you. You have relationships, you have influence, you have opportunities there that the church does not, and we want to help you to utilize every bit of your potential for the sake of reaching the people where you are. What I'm talking about here, ladies and gentlemen, is missional activity. You know, you'll hear this word a whole lot, I'll use it a whole lot. The big difference between church being mission-minded and being missional. First Baptist Church, by and large, mission-minded. Incredibly so. Global focus, our partnerships around the world, the monies that we give, the people that go, and this year more people will go. That is a mission-minded church. Missional, however, churches are people who see not ministry in regards to the institution, but wherever they are, God has placed them, and they are responsible for the relationships God has trusted them with, and they're going to capitalize on those relationships and exhaust those relationships for the purpose of leading people closer and closer to Jesus. That's a paradigm shift. So when I'm talking about meeting the challenges before us, I'm getting a whole lot of feedback here. I don't know why that's happening. When I'm talking about a paradigm shift, I'm talking about changing the focus from the institution to where the people already are, and where you are, guess what? That is where the people are. Now, the Bible gives us a support for this in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11 and following. The Bible says, "For he has gifted some to be apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers." Well, the question is begged. Why so? Why has he gifted some to be apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, teachers? The Bible says in verse 12, "For the equipping of the saints, for the work of the ministry, so that the body of Christ may be built up." We, for the longest time as Southern Baptists, we have viewed that as the call for pastors, teachers, evangelists, prophets, apostles, whatever category you want to put them in. We have viewed that as a process of helping people learn about institutionalized ministry and how they can function and work in the institution. I don't believe that's what the Apostle Paul was speaking about in the church at Ephesus. I don't believe that is what God had in mind. I don't believe that is what Jesus had in mind when he told disciples to go into all the world and to make disciples. The church is responsible to equip the laity, the lay people, people like you and me. We're responsible to be equippers so that we can, where we already are, where God has already placed us, that we can be missional, leading people into a relationship with Jesus Christ. Now, that is threatening to some, because if all the resources are now going to be put to where people are, what's going to happen to the institution? Thus, that is why many churches are afraid to go this direction. They're afraid of what's going to happen to the institution. And yet the Bible says that we ought to be about a kingdom agenda, ladies and gentlemen, not about a church agenda. If I read my Bible correctly, Matthew chapter 16, Jesus said, "I will build my church." You know whose responsibility it is to build the church? Jesus, thank you. There you go. Let me just ask everybody again. I just gave you the right answer. Whose responsibility is it to build the church? Jesus. That's his responsibility. You know why? Because this belongs to him. The church belongs to Jesus. It's not our responsibility. It's not our burden to grow the church. It is our responsibility, and it ought to be the burden of our hearts of how we can affect the kingdom. And the kingdom is about whomever is able to come into a relationship with Jesus Christ. Now, Bob, you're going to win some people to the Lord this year, God willing, at Durham. You're going to be an influence in some people's lives this year at Durham. And there's going to be some people that's going to go to heaven this year as a result of the church coming alongside you and helping you leverage your influence with the people that God's already placed around you. Now, some of those people are going to come back to First Baptist. Some of them, however, are not. Listen, that doesn't matter, because it's not about church growth, it's about kingdom growth, and that also is a different paradigm. You follow that? Paradigm number one. Paradigm number two. Here's a change. Paradigm number two is program-driven ministry versus relational-driven ministry. Program-driven ministry versus a relational-driven ministry. A program-driven ministry, I learned this, and again, did I tell you I was excited about next week's message? I'm so excited to tell you what I've been learning. Because if you ever had like an epiphany, you're like, whoa! I mean, you just got it. I mean, thank you for smiling on me, God. I just got it. I've been in church since I've been 16 years of age. I have seen division and schism all the time. And I used to think, you know, some people are spiritual, some people aren't. You know what I've come to realize? It's not just a spirituality issue. It's a generational issue. We just think differently from different generations because we have different sets of values. We have different perspectives. We have different goals. We have different agendas. We have different wins. And it has nothing sometimes to do with spirituality or not. What it has to do with is just your generation. Let me tell you the generation that I really have become a lot more fond of from the things I've learned are builders. World War II generation. World War II generation called the greatest generation ever. I won't get into all that, but I'll tell you next week. By the way, you need to come back next week. You really, really need to come back to hear what I'm going to say next week. Generational differences. Let me just say about the builders. FDR. FDR. Remember the New Deal? America going through the Great Depression. America, man, just times were bad. I mean, people had to ration. People, you know, I learned, builders, in your generation that there were some people that had a sticker on their car, and if you drove for recreational purpose, you were only able to fill up so much gas. But if you drove because of work-related purposes, you were able to fill up your whole tank. Did y'all know that? I never heard that before. I'm thinking, wow. That's America. That's that generation. That's what they did. And they were willing to make the sacrifice for the greater good of all. That's something to be said for that. The FDR came along and the New Deal said, we're going to help make America better. We're going to help America be better, and we're going to set new programs. We're going to develop these new programs under the umbrella of the New Deal, and these new programs are going to help the unfortunate and the disenfranchised to give them a place of hope and hopefully to get back on their feet. Well, all these programs in that generation was taught the way to solve problems and the way to deal with conflict and the way to handle problems is through programs. Every problem needs a program. By the way, every program needs a committee. Every committee needs a chair, and all committees need to function together so that they're not competing, but they're complementing each other. Does that sound like anything you know? Yeah. Sounds like the government, but you know what it also sounds like? Church! Church! That's exactly what it sounds like. You know why? Because we've adopted an Americanized form of government into the church. We've also adopted an Americanized form of solving problems into the church. The builder generation solved the problems through programs. That's how it was solved in their time, and that is, by and large, how that generation sees problems needing to be solved during this time, through programs. As a result, here at First Baptist, let me just tell you, we got 27 different committees. We have upteen different programs, and the reason is because every problem needs a program, every program needs a committee. Are we understanding each other a little bit better? Generational differences. Can't wait till next week. These generational differences, most churches, by and large, are where they are today and are built to become what they are today because of the sacrifice and the creativity and the ingenuity of our builders. That is why, by and large, our churches look more like the generation of years gone by than the present future, because it was done so on the backs of our builders. Paradigm shift, however, as our culture has changed, so much we, instead of just looking at problems and saying, what program do we need to bring about to meet this dilemma, to face this challenge, to solve this problem, the idea is, what relationships can we build? Because you see, the universal language now, ladies and gentlemen, is not problems being solved by programs, but the universal language is relationships. It is connection. It is community. It is relational. Now that is not a new thing. Because you see, the whole Christian message, the whole gospel revolves around relationships. They asked Jesus one day, they said, what's the greatest commandment? What did Jesus say? He said two things. He said, love what? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. That's the greatest commandment. And the second, next to that, is what? Love your neighbor as yourself. So loving God and loving your neighbor, is that a program or is that a relationship? That's a relationship. And so listen, the very basis of our Christian faith is based upon, centered upon, grounded upon a relationship. It is relational at its core. Yet, most of what the church does is programmatic at its core. It is, here's needs, here's problems, we want to solve problems. I understand that. When I was at Riverbend, I remember a bunch of people started getting saved, coming into the church. I, as a young pastor, young and dumb, didn't know very much. I thought, you know, we got all these needs, we got all these people. But what we need to do is we need to start different programs. We need to start different ministries to help meet the needs of the people God is bringing our way. So as a result, man, we had a smorgasbord of all different kinds of ministries and programs that we started for the sake of helping all the people that were coming with all their problems. And as a result, much less got done, and probably very, very little help was given, even though we had the best of intentions. And so here's the difference. Let's say a Sunday school class. Sunday school class, again, going back to builders, you'll hear about that next week, going back to builders, and really to boomers, but more so to builders, the whole idea of a Sunday school class, a Bible study, it was content-driven. It was driven by what we're going to learn, what we're going to know differently, how we're going to see things differently. In my generation, Generation X, especially after my generation, Generation Y, or the millennials, those born between 1984 and 2000, they don't even know that type of culture. They speak the language. We speak the language of relationships. And so, case in point, a couple of Wednesday nights ago, we got together. And I had, and by the way, Wednesday nights mostly made up of builders, mostly made up of our World War II generation. And so I'm talking to them. We're instead of a Bible study, what I do is I go around and I say, I want you to share with me your favorite memory from church. History past, share with me your favorite memory. And I tell you what, it was really neat. We had this person over here talking about, I walked forward when I was 14 years of age. I gave my life to Jesus at a revival. And it was his story. Another individual, they talked about a time in their life, a very special memory they have of church. And what we did is we got to know each other a little bit better. We got to see each other a little bit better. We started to appreciate each other a little bit more. We just started sharing our stories. We started sharing our narratives. Well, as I left there, I thought, when? That was wonderful. God bless. We connected. We experienced community. And yet I heard afterwards there were people disappointed because we didn't have a Bible study. Now listen, don't throw stones. We're just talking about a generational difference. We're just talking about generational differences because, again, in the generational mindset, when we meet together, when it's time for Bible study, we want to learn content. We want to be informed. We want greater knowledge than what we came here with. This paradigm that I'm discussing with you, it's not content absence. It's not like we're not concerned about content. It's just not going to be driven by content. See, in this paradigm, I believe that spiritual growth best takes place not in a class, but through a relationship. And if I were to ask you here today, how many of you came to faith in Jesus Christ through an individual's influence? Most of you would raise your hand. If I ask you today, how many of you have progressed in your walk with Jesus? How many of you today have moved along in your journey? You're closer to Jesus today because of a relationship in your life and someone who encouraged you, someone who loved you, someone who spurred you on when you felt like giving up. If I were to ask you that question, most of you also would raise your hand. That is why I am where I am today. And so in this paradigm, I believe that it's in the context of spiritual relationships that spiritual growth best takes place. And so the idea is not so much what program can we create to solve a problem, but listen, because it's relational, what environment can we create whereby relationships best take place? And by and large, churches have done a very, very poor job because, again, it's really hard to be relational when you're program-driven. That's why people like yourself and myself can be in church year after year, and you have been raised in church. Maybe you come to church every Sunday. Maybe you're a leader in church. But I've heard this time and time again from people I've pastored and people my friends have pastored where they say this, I do not have any friends in church. I've been blown away by that. Some of the churches I've pastored, somebody will come to me that is just, I mean, you would think that everybody knows them. They know everybody else. They're a leader. And this person privately would say, I'm lonely. I don't have any friends.
Because see, it's one thing for people to know your name. It's one thing for people to know where you work. It's one thing to know about somebody's hobbies. It's another thing to know somebody, their heart, what they fear, what they're tempted by, what they struggle with. What are their dreams? What are their joys? What are their insecurities? On that type of level, I'm telling you what, the church has done a poor job, by and large, of fostering those type of relationships and cultivating environments that are conducive to build those type of relationships. So paradigm shift is going from program to relational. Now, how does all that play out? What are the action steps in that? Listen, that's another discussion for another day. I'm just telling you a difference of philosophy, a difference of paradigm. And speaking of, let me just tell you how that works. Wasn't prepared to do this. This morning I got to my office, got an email. It's a friend of mine back from Riverbend. Had the chance to see my friend here, Brent is his name, come to faith in Jesus our first year there. His wife sung in our praise team. He says, Matt, without going into my struggles and frustrations, I wanted to say thank you for your friendship. The time and energy, and then in parentheses, and often finances, you invest in my life mean more than you'll ever realize. Recently, I've been thinking about some of the people from Riverbend, and I miss what we had. They moved. They're in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina right now, a new church. He said, I miss what we had. At the risk of sounding gay, parentheses, I'm not. It was at Riverbend where I learned I could honestly love another man without being gay. Guys like you and Danny are an irreplaceable part of my life. It's not like I had a need or something that only you guys could fill. There was just a friendship that I've never experienced before. I miss that. I don't have many friends like that. Thank you for being one of them. Relational. Relational ministry. Bearing fruit. I've been away from Riverbend now almost 4 years. Bearing fruit. A long time. Maybe into eternity. So the whole idea of a change in paradigm, going from program-driven to relational-driven. By the way, tonight we're going to get back into our discussion groups. You know what I heard over and over from our discussion groups from the first time we did it? Because see, we just did it randomly. We didn't say, okay, we're going to put the builders with the builders, and we're going to put the Generation Xers with the Generation Xers, and we're going to put the busters with the busters, and we're going to put the boomers with the boomers. No, we just said, you know what, just here's a number. And so by and large, groups, they had some of our builders in it, and they also had some of our youth in it. And they were able to discuss, they were able to have conversations, and I heard over and over from last week, you know what, it was really interesting hearing from people that I normally wouldn't be in conversation with. You know what you had? You experienced a little bit of community. You experienced a little bit of relational community. It kind of felt good. You kind of liked it. It was a little taste of how good it can be. Tonight we're going to do the same. You won't be back for that. Third paradigm, and I'm moving quickly. Third paradigm, paradigm shift. Real estate ministry versus community partnerships. Real estate ministry versus community partnerships. 40 Days of Purpose. Y'all did this here, I think, about a year or so ago. I was told y'all did not do this aspect of the 40 Days of Purpose, but in most 40 Days of Purpose, you do, however, do this. You will have a ministry fair. Have you ever had a ministry fair here at First Baptist? Here's what ministry fair is. People set up booths. This is our ministry. We want to try to get you involved in our ministry. And they line up all around the church. They'd probably be all around the foyer out there. And people would come by and they would inquire about your ministry and what you're offering and why it's good to be a part of your ministry and where the needs are. It's called a ministry fair. My friend back in South Carolina, he's going to have a ministry fair in a couple of weeks through the 40 Days of Purpose. Mostly those ministries, however, have to do with, again, real estate ministry. The ministry that takes place at 311 North Madison Avenue. When a church goes through a spiritual gifts survey and you take a spiritual gifts, you've wised up to it, great, they're looking for workers. And you almost don't want to participate in it because you're thinking, you know, I don't want them to know what skills I have. I don't want them to know what I'm good at because you're afraid you're going to get signed up for a job at 311 North Madison Avenue. This paradigm says, you know what? The real ministry is going to take place. It's not going to take place on this real estate piece of property, but in our community. I ask the question. If First Baptist were to be wiped out, if we were to be removed from this community, would our community even miss us? By and large, right now, would our community skip a beat? Do we have such a presence in our community? Do we have such a partnership with our community that if we were to leave, there would be like, oh my goodness, what are we going to do now? Where has that group of influencers gone. What are we going to do now without their partnerships? By and large, churches, they could be wiped off their city's map and the city wouldn't skip a beat. You know why? Because all that's usually done within a church takes place on that church's real estate piece of property. It's not done out in community. This paradigm is about community transformation. It's not so much about trying to get you to sign up for a job here. It's about, listen, creating opportunities out in our community where you can partner. The group I was in, Kathy Qualls was the leader of it. And a couple of Sunday nights ago, and we were talking about, you know, building relationships and stuff. And one individual, she's a builder generation. She said, you know what? It's just kind of hard for my generation. It's kind of hard for us to build new relationships. She says, you know what? I thought this was a great idea. She goes, you know what? Maybe what the church can do is kind of create opportunities for us out in the community to rub shoulders with people that we normally would not rub shoulders with. And as a result, and they even said, kind of get into another clique. She said it, I didn't. She goes, and we can kind of get into another clique. And as a result of that, we might be able to influence people that we're not in relationship with at this present time. At the same time, doing work in the community that everybody sees as being of value. Community projects. I've been praying. Because again, as pastor, most of my ministry, most of my time, most of my efforts, most of my skills is used up at 311 North Madison Avenue. Well, I'm a preacher, but I'm first a Christian. I want to be out in the community. I want to be about community transformation. I don't want this paradigm just to be for you. I want it to be for me. I want to be out there touching life. So I've been praying ever since I got here. As a matter of fact, before I even got here as your pastor, I was praying. Miss Glenda would tell you this. I was praying. I was hoping to be a part of the high school football team. You know what happened the other day? This is just word of praise. Happened the other day. I was praying, and it's been upon my heart. I need to go talk to the coach over here at the high school. I need to go talk to the coach over here at high school. And throughout the couple of days that week, I was thinking, you know what? I need to go over there and talk to that coach. And just things happened. I wasn't able to do it. Tony called my phone there in the office. She said, you know, Coach Christian's here to see you. Do you have some time? I said, man, send that guy on back. He came on back. He dropped off a little helmet, from the high school. And I said, hey, listen, you got a second? And I just shared with him. I said, listen, I love Jesus, but, you know, next to that is my family. Next to that is football. I would love to be a part any way I could. You think you have a place that you might be able to use somebody who knows a little bit about, you know, the game? And he said, well, I don't know if I have any, you know, paid positions up. I said, I ain't looking to get paid. I just want a place, just to volunteer, just come alongside. And it kind of took him back. He's like, you just want to volunteer? I said, yeah, I just want to volunteer. Just want to come out there and volunteer. He said, well, you know, don't do that to everybody, but you know what? He goes, I got to know you a little bit. And he says, sure, you come on out. He said, I'll send you a schedule of what we do and when we're starting. I thought to myself, thank you, Jesus. Yes, that's an answer to my prayers. Because, see, I don't have just to be isolated here at 311 North Madison Avenue. I can be out there in the community, and I'm going to be rubbing shoulders with some football players. I'm going to be meeting their parents. I'm going to be building some relationships outside of the First Baptist world. Hot dog! It's not because I don't like you either. It's just that you're already going to go to heaven, most of you. Not all of you, but most of you. You're already going to go to heaven. I want to be around some people who aren't going there yet. And I want to be a part of their lives and helping them have the assurance that they will go one day. And so we as a church, we want to foster and create opportunities where we can partner with those outside of us in our community so that we really do become a viable presence within our community. And again, as we do that, some people are going to follow us back here to First Baptist, but you know what? A lot of people, they're not going to come back to First Baptist. That's okay, because it's not about church growth. It's about what kind of growth? Kingdom growth. You let God take care of His church. Let God grow the church however He wants to grow it. But we just want to partner with God, invest in lives, and impact the kingdom. That's what it means to live missional, partnering lives with God. And then last, here it is, and I'll do this very, very quickly. My time, I didn't do it well. Paradigm number four, this has to do more with perception than reality. But I would like to change the perception. See, most people, when they think of church, they think of people who go to church as people who have their acts together. And so, by and large, people who realize I don't have my act together, they don't feel comfortable in a place like this. Well, we need to let them in on a little secret, don't we? No, we need to be honest and let them in on a little secret. Here's a little secret. We don't have all of our acts together either. We got our struggles. We have our fears. We have our sin. We have our temptations. We sometimes don't get along. We sometimes don't know how to act. We sometimes choose wrong when we should be choosing right. Hey, we understand sin. We understand failure. We understand dilemma. But by and large, the outside community, the culture at large, they don't think we know that yet. And maybe some of us don't. So let me fill you in on the secret. Ain't none of us have arrived. Ain't none of us there yet. We still got a long way to go. You're still raw. I'm still raw. We're all works in progress. And I want it to be known. I want the perception to be changed. I want the paradigm to be different where the church, and listen, it's an old cliche and I'm hesitant even using it, but we're not a museum here. We're not a museum where we just show ourselves off. Look at us. We've arrived. Be like us. By the way, I think we've pretty much reached everybody in the community that wants to be like us. So we got to go fishing in another pond now. By and large, we have probably reached and influenced and attracted all the people that there are in our community who want to be like us. So we got to go fishing somewhere else. People who really don't care to be like us. They say, not like us? Yeah, not like you, not like me. So we got to go where they are. We got to be honest. We got to be vulnerable. We got to be a place that they can bring their junk to. We got to be a place. We got to be a real hospital here. You know, hospitals. They, you know, Karen, you work there. It gets messy sometimes. You know, we try to make it sterile. We try to make it clean. But when it really gets down to the nitty gritty, it gets messy sometimes. Well, if you really want to deal with real people, real problems, real sin, real dilemma, real hurt, it's going to have to get messy in the First Baptist Church. And the First Baptist Churches of America. And we need to be a place where, you know what? You can fail and you can still be accepted. You can mess up and you're still going to be loved. You're going to be loved just as you are, and you're also going to be loved enough not to let you stay that way. We're going to love you back to life. We're going to love you, thus showing you the love of Jesus that melts our hearts, because the Bible says the kindness of God is what brings us to repentance. I'll share this story and I'm done. Back at Riverbend, we had a secretary, my first secretary when I was there. Her name was Miss Rosinda. Loved Miss Rosinda. She was a single mom, three teenage boys. She had a tough, tough time. Barely just trying to make ends meet and all that. Found out that some money had been missing from the church. And the guy that was before me, my predecessor, he kind of hung on and kind of mentoring me through my first year there. He started looking into it. And lo and behold, long story short, Miss Rosinda had been taking money from the offering plate. Well, we didn't know how much, but we knew it had been taking place for some time. And when I found out, I was thinking, you know, how did that start? I'm sure Mr. Zinda probably, you know, took a little bit and said, you know, I'll return it. And then maybe she did. And after a while, she took a little bit and she couldn't return it. She says, well, I'll make it up next week or whatever. But it eventually became a pattern, became a habit. And so I don't know how much money the church lost, but Mr. Zinda was caught red-handed. Now, again, when you deal with sin, you do it privately. You don't make it public, but I do not know to this day how it was done, but it got to the news media. And so now it's all over the news there in Charleston. Church secretary embezzling money, Riverbend Baptist Church. You say, man, that's bad for the church. Yeah, but my heart went out more to Miss Rosinda than it did the church. Because Miss Rosinda is my sister, and I loved her. Good, bad, and ugly. I love Miss Rosinda. We love Miss Rosinda. We went to Miss Rosinda. We talked to her. Miss Rosinda, she was broken. She repented. It was a Sunday morning. I was given the invitation. I wasn't even preaching on it. Miss Rosinda sitting back in the back row. She walks forward. She comes. She says, man, I'd like to say something to the church. I said, sure, Miss Rosinda. She got up and she told the church how sorry she was, how so ashamed she was. And she asked their forgiveness. I'm telling you what, it was, when we talked last Wednesday night about our favorite church members, this was one of my favorite church memories. I tell you, the church just stood up and they just applauded. And I tell you what, they one by one, and before long, hardly anybody was sitting in the pews. They were all up here hugging Miss Rosinda. Restoring her, bringing her back to life, letting her know, okay, we understand you failed, but you're more important than your failure. God's grace is bigger than your failures. And we're going to be the body of Christ here. I'm telling you what, Mr. Rosinda, for the rest of my time there, Mr. Rosinda kept coming Sunday after Sunday. I'm telling you, she did not come because she was feeling like she was being judged Sunday after Sunday, or she had to make up something back. I'm telling you, she came because she understood this is not a museum, this is a hospital, and you can fail, and you can have your sin, and you can have your shortcomings, and you're going to be loved as you are, and yet loved enough not to let you stay that way. That's what the church needs to become. Now, perception and reality, I understand, aren't all the time the same. But perception to some is reality. And so those who have that perception, First Baptist, we need to change it. We need to do whatever it takes to change it. So those are paradigms. What's the strategy for all that? Don't know yet. What's the action points for all that? That's still up for debate. But you want to understand your pastor, you want to understand your leader, where I'm working from, that's it. Instead of institutionalized ministry, we're going to be missional. Instead of trying to get you to come here and do a job, Bob, we're going to go to where you are and help you do the job of the evangelist better. Instead of being program-driven, we're going to solve every problem in the program. No, we're going to do it by relationships, one relationship at a time. We're going to connect. We're going to experience community because in spiritual growth or spiritual relationship, spiritual growth best takes place. Number three, we're not going to be about real estate ministry. It's not going to all be about 311 North Madison Avenue. It's going to be at our community, and we're going to be in our community. We're going to be infiltrating our community. We're going to be penetrating our community with the love of Jesus and the affection of Christ and skilled hands. And as a result, we're going to become more viable in our community, and we're going to affect the kingdom. And three, we're going to change this perception that we got our acts together. We're going to become a place of honesty, vulnerability, openness, and even brokenness. And saying, you know what? You fit in real well here. People say, I don't want to go to church because it's full of hypocrites. I say, come join us. You'll fit right in.